Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction, the podcast that asks the question, how'd you get your science in my movie?
How'd you get your movie in my science?
They're the two great tastes that taste great together. I am Scott Weinberg, a film critic, which is a really impressive career, until you consider what my partner does, Dr. Steven DeGennaro, astrophysicist and filmmaker.
Former astrophysicist.
You're never a former.
I'm a non-practicing. I'm a recovering astrophysicist.
You're never a former astrophysicist, Stephen. How dare you? Come on. Okay, Stephen, why don't you explain to our listeners why we're doing three movies this week instead of two?
We have always wanted to do a triple header, and this seemed like the perfect opportunity to talk about three different movies that are nominally based on the same story, and yet very different from one another. And so I think they provide an interesting contrast.
But then, you know what, Steve? It also raises the issue of it's an interesting little trio of films because on one hand, we're talking about three films that are adapting the same source material.
Sort of, nominally.
Yeah, but the 1982 version definitely has some visual and you know, a little, some the Easter egg type little tidbits there. From the 1951 film, and the 2011 one does the same thing with the 1982. So there is some connective tissue between the three, which, you know, it makes it kind of fun to watch them all together.
Yeah.
So we'll get to why I'm really interested in doing this episode after the first film, which is 1951's The Thing, parenthetical, from another world.
Is it really parenthetical?
It is a parenthetical, I believe. Huh. I always thought it was.
I don't know.
Maybe I'm mistaken. The Thing from Another World, which is a 1951 film produced by Uber producer Howard Hawks. And you could be forgiven for thinking that Howard Hawks directed this film because he has the proprietary credit and his name is all over it. But the director is actually a gentleman named Christian Nyby.
Well, this was back in the days before the auteur theory when the director just basically called action and cut.
Based on the short story, a 1938 novella by John W. Campbell Jr. called Who Goes There?
Question mark.
Question mark. Who Goes There? And if you are a fan of any of these films, then I should mention to you that the source material, Who Goes There, is available online to read for free.
Hmm. Interesting.
So there you go. Now you can spend 15 minutes reading that. And then maybe next time you watch any of these films, you'll come in with a different perspective because now you know how to read. Congratulations. And what's really interesting, Stephen, like these three movies, it's like, you know, the 1951 film is very well regarded, but if you love the 1982 one, then the 1951 is definitely your dad's The Thing. And now, since there is a 2011 version and the 1982 version is so old, of course, the 1982 version is now your dad's version of The Thing.
Yeah, except that I don't think there are any teenagers that watched the 2011 version and went, oh, this movie's awesome. It's so much better than the 1982 version.
Yeah, all right. So let's start with the original, which is a 1951 black and white, starchy, dry, definitely influential, definitely important film, but I hate to say it, I've seen it now three times throughout my life. It's kind of dull.
It's nominally an adaptation, but it really borrows almost nothing from the original source story. It's certainly not the elements that made the later versions as famous and beloved as they are. It, you know, it resets it to the North Pole instead of Antarctica for reasons that I couldn't even fathom, except maybe there's a scene where they talk about encountering a bear, and there are no bears at the South Pole. But similar to all the rest of them, you know, they discover – well, so in this case, they don't discover a ship that has been there for a long time. They actually see the ship crash and follow it out to where it crashed into, and the ice has already frozen over the top of it, which they do a whole bunch of dialogue about why that is, but I didn't follow any of it, and it didn't make any sense to me at all.
Right. And like I said, I've reviewed thousands of movies in my life, so I do have this ability to put myself in the mindset of when the film came out. You know, you cannot judge a 1951 movie to a 1982 to a 2011. People are different. The way what we like in our movies is different.
Oh, yeah.
So it almost feels like this 1951 movie is from another world or another culture.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, and it's got, like, this kind of jocular tone of these kind of happy-go-lucky.
They don't seem particularly frightened, no, for most of this movie.
They seem mostly horny. There's a lot of horny dialogue in this movie. There's a lot of...
Except it's 1950 horny, which means, hey, we should get married and not, hey, yep, we should bone.
And most people don't know this about... So they find this creature frozen in a block of ice, and they bring it back to their facility. And then we get the real point of the movie, which is, in my opinion, it's the most blatant anti-electric blanket propaganda I've ever seen. The entire universe is put at risk because of an electric blanket. And let me tell you—
because of an idiot that uses an electric blanket, to be fair. Electric blankets don't release aliens. People release aliens. Come on.
That's true. That's true. Now, one thing I can't do, as much as I would like to, is put myself in the 1950s mindset. And, Stephen, as this movie goes from exploration to carrot-based monster in two sequences— can you kind of extrapolate what about this movie would have scared you in 1950?
Who knows? I don't understand what would scare anybody about most of these old classic movies. I think they're all kind of cheesy and a little, I say that. I do think that there is something about, especially if you had never seen it before, the idea of, oh, there's this alien creature and it's unstoppable and it can literally reproduce by, chopping bits of itself off, which it feels like is kind of the only thing from the source material that it actually kept.
Yeah.
Right? Because what it does not do, which it does in the original novella, which it does in both of the later versions of the movie, is assume people's identity by, replicating their cells and imitating them. And so that sense of paranoia of, oh, I don't know who I can trust and who I can't, is entirely absent from this movie.
Yeah, it's a good example of how a pretty good film can still only scratch the surface of a good premise, and then it takes maybe another filmmaker or two to build on something there, because like you said, there's some stuff in the 82 version that is infinitely more fascinating than what we get here.
Well, but this was a typical thing they did in Hollywood back in the day, though. I mean, they did it, if you look at Dracula and Frankenstein and a lot of the early monster movies, they took the novels, the source material, as like vague jumping off points to completely reimagine a thing. And in this case, literally the title of the original novella is Who Goes There? Like, the basic premise of the story as this thing can imitate people and that causes everybody to be paranoid is right there in the title. It is so much a part of the original story that it's like you could almost keep that part of the story and lose the alien part of it, and it would make more sense than what they did here.
Right, and it made me wonder, watching the movie, I'm thinking, why do they have a guy in a suit as the monster when it would be easier, cheaper, and better to just have them staring at each other, paranoid? The movie has an interesting tone. It's got like what I'd call like a pre-Altman tone, because a lot of the characters talk over each other. They're all talking about dames this and, broads that, and very dated.
And they tack on this ridiculous, unnecessary romantic subplot where there's a woman there who is somebody's secretary, the doctor's secretary, I guess, and she and the head of the military captain who is there investigating this thing.
They got a lot of awkward flirting to do.
Yeah. Well, they have a history, apparently, and now that history is coming to the fore, and none of those scenes advance the plot in any way whatsoever.
Nope. It kind of feels like a third of a 1948 screwball comedy just got wedged into a sci-fi thriller.
Yeah.
I'll give the movie a lot of credit for it, like location, production design. I mean, it sets the stage pretty well. It's creepy. I could see, if I had seen this when I was 15 and of that era, that, yeah, I would really like this movie. But having grown up on the 82 version and now coming back to the original several times, I want to approach it with, the respect that it deserves and all that, but I just simply can't get around the fact that it's dull to me. It just bores me.
Well, it takes forever for things to get going in the thing. Yeah. And, like, the third act is what would be the end of the first act or the midpoint in a modern movie, if that. And, they have one climactic battle with this alien, and they defeat it, and then that's it. It's over. It does, however, introduce an element that we're probably going to talk about in relation to all three of these films, both for scientific as well as filmic reasons, which is using flamethrowers indoors.
Okay, go ahead.
And whether or not, whether or not that is a good idea.
You want to hold that for the next movie, which is Flamethrower Central? Or?
Yes, yes. We'll okay. go ahead and we'll wait. But I just wanted to point out that it is introduced yeah. in, you know, that you can only kill it with fire is one thing that is introduced in this movie that is true of all three of the films.
Of the things in the film that I like, it has a wonderful score by Dmitri Tomkin. The premise and the location gives a composer clearly ample opportunity to write something ominous and creepy and yep. effective. And I think that this, even the original, has a great score. And one thing, Stephen, that I thought was fascinating, and I saw it in a lot of movies growing up. It's not really in our sci-fi as much anymore as it used to, which is communicate versus exterminate. The scientist in this movie, at risk of his own life, right. more than once insists that the way to deal with this alien is to try and communicate. And it's interesting, Stephen, that he's kind of drawn as the mild villain.
Yes.
In that, because he wants to communicate, the military wants to blow it up. They're logical and sensible.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was what I was about to say. Like, it is an interesting thing that he is definitely coded as the villain of this movie. Well, the human villain of this movie, obviously the thing is the villain, but he is the, you know, antagonist to our hero, who is Dirk Squarejaw, military guy, who is defying orders from his own superiors to try to kill this thing because they also want to preserve it. But he, I guess, alone realizes that if this thing gets out, which again, that's flipped from the original story, where it is the doctor character, you know, who starts destroying things so that it won't be able to get out, and who recognizes the danger of it first, which I believe is also true of the 82 version in Wilford Brimley's character, although I never fully understood what Wilford Brimley's character's role in the...
Oh, well, we're not talking about that movie yet. We're wrapping up.
Anyway, yeah. So, I don't know. Scientifically, there's not a whole lot to chew on in this movie, you know?
Yeah, the monster is... The explanation is that it's some kind of vegetable based. It's not an animal. It is somehow vegetable based. And
right.
I give them points because that creates an alien that is truly alien on the page.
Yep.
But visually, there's no real connection there.
It looks like Frankenstein. Yeah. It just looks like a guy with a fake forehead. No, I mean, that's an interesting thing. You know, they talk about how, you know, the cellular structure resembles a plant, and that's why, you know, and then at one point they actually do, they put it in the soil and start growing little alien sproutlings. It's hard to imagine just from a physiological point of view. Now, I'm not a biologist, but I am a physicist and I understand how physics works. So I have a vague understanding of how muscles work because it's basically physics. But I don't see how you get a plant that is capable of the things that this thing does.
Yeah.
You know, just its structure, its cellular structure is not built to do that kind of thing. I mean, there's a reason why you don't see plants weightlifting.
I like the attempt. And I give the writers credit for, hey, you know what? If instead of it just being like an alien that looks like either like a biped or a quadruped or something, let's give a concept that the viewer will not really be able to fully grasp, which is it is a living organism that is plant or vegetable based, and that makes it infinitely more alien, you know,
yeah.
than just something that might look like a vague human or a vague dog or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, given the technology of the 1950s, you know, the best you were going to get is a guy in a suit.
Well, a guy in a suit and also what looks suspiciously like human clothing. And that was another thing that felt sort of really weird to me. Like, it looks like he's just wearing like a cardigan and a pair of jeans that are kind of a little bit torn up.
So, Stephen, having watched this film now for the first time, like, I get why War of the Worlds, Day the Earth Stood Still, Incredible Shrinking Man. I easily get why those are considered sci-fi classics. I watch this and I think, decent, but I just...
Is it considered a sci-fi classic, though? Really?
I just don't love it. I don't. I think it is considered a classic, and well,
except
I
wonder how much of that has to do with the later version, because I wonder whether people would really remember this movie if it had not been remade. I mean, I only know it in the context of, oh, The Thing was a remake of this movie or, you know, a readaptation of the source material. So I don't know. I could be wrong. Maybe that's my own ignorance of that era of film, but it's certainly, I don't think, something that gets regularly talked about as being on par with stuff like The Day the Earth Stood Still or War of the Worlds. Or
oh, no, I wouldn't say on par, but it is, I think, probably just the title and, you know, the I think it is considered a, let's say, a minor classic. Definitely influential and definitely worth checking out if you are a fan of the history of the genre. But, yeah, as far as, like, ancient classics are concerned, this one just leaves me a bit cold.
I will say this, though. It does have, statistically speaking, twice as many women as any other version of The Thing and infinite times more than the 1982 John Carpenter version.
Any other science points come out to you regarding the original Thing, Stephen?
Again, there's just not a whole lot of science in it. I can't... I mean, I'm only thinking about this now as we're talking about it, but I do wonder... I know that when it freezes here in Austin, which is fairly rare, but happens, you know, at least once a year, that my wife goes around the house and brings all of the potted plants that are outside inside the house because the frost will usually kill them. So I do wonder how this thing wearing its, you know, cardigan and jeans manages to survive for that long out in the cold. But I don't know. I guess it's science fiction.
Can you just is it legit to just hand wave that away by saying, look, alien physiology?
Well, yes, obviously you can hand wave that away. But, you know, they go out of their way to talk about how the cellular structure is like plants, which means, you know, a cellular structure, which means rigid structures mostly filled with water. If it's going out and whether that's that cold, I can't imagine that it wouldn't become incredibly brittle, which maybe it does. Maybe that's why the dog is able to snap the hand off of it. Or maybe it's brittle to begin with because they do describe it as a carrot. But, you know, if you've ever seen a frozen plant, aside from the fact that it will kill it, it becomes very brittle and you could break off pieces of it. But I guess in this case, as long as it can survive that process, that's actually a good thing because that's more or less this thing's getting laid is breaking pieces off of itself because that's how it reproduces.
And I think, and this is how we'll segue over, this is what I like a lot about the 82 version is that, like you said, they extrapolate ideas set up in the short story and the original film, and Carpenter and his screenwriter, Bill Lancaster, build on that, build on the paranoia, the isolation, all that stuff. So, Stephen, let us now move over to The Thing 1982, which I can give just a little bit of history, came out right after E.T. It famously didn't do a lot of business. And it infamously got a lot of bad reviews from critics who were not really prepared for the goriness of the film. And I, having read a lot of those contemporary reviews, a good portion of them are just focused on the makeup effects.
Yeah.
And it's like any other asset that might be in the film is a distant, distant echo in those reviews. And I've always kind of loved to defend this movie, but the older I get, the more I realize that it doesn't need my defense because the people who love it vastly outnumber the people who don't. And Stephen has seen this film once as a kid, and he remembers not loving it. And now here's what's fun. He watched it again yesterday, and we have not spoken since yesterday. So we're going to, I guess, maybe break with our format and just cut right to it. And I'm going to ask you, Stephen, did you like The Thing 82 more the second time around?
So I'm going to get pilloried for this, especially after that massive thread that you started on Twitter, in which lots of people jumped in with their memories of this beloved movie. But my opinion of it has not changed at all. I don't think it's a bad movie, but it does nothing for me. I can't find myself emotionally engaged in it at all. Again, I'm going to get really pilloried for this, but I find the practical effects to be kind of cheesy and dated and not very good and not very convincing.
We're going to have to cancel this show.
Not very scary. And so, like, I don't hate this movie. I think it's, you know, well made. And, I can see what people love in it. I can see why it's influential, but it just doesn't do it for me. Sorry.
I'm stunned. I am stunned. I honestly thought that between, like, I love everything about this movie. I love the Ennio Morricone score. I love the mysterious open that makes you wonder why the hell is this guy in an airplane or in a helicopter shooting at a dog.
Well, so it's hard.
I'm not done yet.
Yeah.
I love the cast. I love every character actor face in this movie. Now, as far as the, you know, the lack of women, yeah. On one hand, yeah, representation would be nice, especially in a great, great movie like this. On the other hand, I guess the logic is in this era, in this industry, women would be very scarce. And I guess that is the logic behind, you know, but I also think it plays a psychological aspect into the film as well. I think that left completely to their own devices, men quickly devolve to violence and paranoia and mistrust. I think that in many cases, women are a calming influence or a logical influence in a situation like this. And I think that it was a conscious choice to have them all be mostly alpha men in this situation and see how they handle it on their own. It's kind of an experiment, if you want to take it that way. So do I see how watching it now feels a little weird, considering that an entire gender is not represented? Yeah, a little. It does.
I would disagree with that. Like, I wasn't even necessarily pointing it out as a negative. I think that in this particular case, that absolutely works. I think that you're right. I think that there's it has a very masculine energy to it. And I think that inserting a female character into this, as we see sort of in some sense with the prequel, would give it a very different energy. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a better or a worse energy, but I think that I don't think the movie suffers for lack of representation at all in terms of its artistic ambitions.
And what I do find interesting is that Carpenter knows what he's doing, because it is an all-male cast, but the first voice you hear in the movie is a female computer voice. I thought that was – I think that's kind of funny.
Well, so let's talk about that scene for a second. It's a very short scene. It has no bearing on the plot.
It absolutely does.
It's literally there to introduce Kurt Russell's character as somebody who – he must be smart because he's playing chess, but he also drinks whiskey.
No, I think it's just kind of the opposite. He's smart enough to play chess, but he'd rather destroy the computer than lose to a computer. It's the same thing that happens at the end of the film. He would rather blow up the whole base than let the thing win.
Oh, I guess maybe I hadn't even thought of that, but I don't know.
That's why, yeah, I studied film, and, you know, what'd you do? What'd you do? Studied planets?
Oh, I only wrote one.
Yeah,
distribution, sorry.
I just love how they piece together the mystery in this movie. I just like all of it. There's nothing about this movie I don't like.
All right, so here may be a clue to my lack of enjoyment in this movie. So I saw this movie probably 15, so it would have been 1992, 93. It was well after it had come out. I can't recall exactly which specific moments had been spoiled, but I knew the premise of the whole thing. I knew – so all of this mystery, all of the that you're talking about, all of this, oh, like, you know, the Scooby-Doo aspect of, oh, we got to figure out what this thing is. What are the Norwegians doing? Why are they shooting at this dog? Like, I knew all of that stuff going into the movie. And so all of that just played to me like, okay, get on with it. I know what's happening.
Right, but I've seen the movie 9 times, and I'm still fascinated and entertained by the way he unfolds this story. It never gets old for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's good for you. I'm just saying, like, knowing the story, like, even the what is probably the most surprising moment in the movie for anybody who knows nothing about the movie, would be the chestburster scene.
You can't blame a film for the knowledge you have or don't have.
I'm not blaming the film. I'm merely expressing my subjective —
this is going to get ugly —
experience of watching the movie. And I cannot divorce myself from knowing what the movie is about. And so that entire first 45 minutes doesn't feel tense and revelatory to me. It just feels perfunctory.
Ominous. Ominous, maybe not tense. Maybe the first act is ominous and moody and just interesting because it's a weird location and all that. And this is an interesting group of guys to a point.
That's to a point. That's the other part of the issue, right? Okay. That's the other main thing that keeps me from engaging in this thing. So I there's Kurt Russell's character, who is a helicopter pilot, but also apparently eventually the leader of all these people for some reason. And then there is Wilford Brimley, who is the only other character in the entire thing that feels like a standout to me. Whereas everybody else just feels like this wash of just like, meh, none of them are given any personalities.
I disagree. Oh, I disagree. Palmer, the pothead, is good. Dr. Copper, Richard Dysart, he's great. Keith David as Childs, he's really good. Richard Macer, the sad sack who watches over the dogs.
I'm not saying that any of the actors are bad. I'm saying that they're not given interesting enough stuff to do.
Interesting enough to get you into the —
well, they're not interesting enough to get me into the premise. That's my entire point, is that they're not. I don't find any of them compelling characters, including Kurt Russell's character. The only character in this entire thing that I think was actually decent is Wilford Brimley's, and that's probably almost entirely due to his performance and also due to the fact that he's the only person really who does anything unexpected or does anything that seems like it defines who his character is, because he realizes, oh crap, this stuff's going to get out. I better destroy everything. And he, you know, goes on this rampage and destroys the thing. And that's a great scene. And
thematically, that's one of my favorite points in this movie, is that once he figures it out, what the alien wants, he becomes paranoid and terrified. And that makes him look more suspicious.
Right. But he rightfully so. Like, you know, and he has all of the best stuff in this movie. And he's genuinely frightening at times. In that scene where he's, you know, he's shooting at people while he's destroying the computers, and then later on there's a moment where they go to his cabin that they've locked him in, and he's like, come on guys, let me out. I lost my head a little earlier, but I'm totally fine now, I promise.
Right. And what I find that scene fascinating, because he sounds normal.
Yeah.
But they're looking at him, he's just saying things like, I won't harm anyone. Like,
yeah.
Who says that? Like, you could, like, with the perspective of having seen the movie and knowing that Dr. Blair is the creature, it adds another wrinkle to that conversation.
Well, yes and no, because also, like, he did hurt somebody. He shot somebody, didn't he not?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, he has a legitimate reason to say, look, I promise I won't hurt anybody else. Like, and that's what's interesting about that scene, and the writing in that scene is the fact that, like, you genuinely don't know whether this is the guy who kind of lost his mind and is now kind of recovering, or the guy who lost his mind and then became the thing later on.
Right. So to those very few people who might be listening who don't know the premise, in this film, the doctor and the helicopter pilot go over to a Norwegian base and discover that they have discovered a flying saucer and an occupant that had been thrown. They brought that thing frozen back to their base, and it thawed out. And it went crazy, and they fought back. The only surviving portion of the alien, clearly, was in this Siberian husky pup, beautiful dog.
And so this thing can shapeshift. The smallest part of it is capable of basically infiltrating a person or another living creature and shapeshifting to take over its not just its form, but its thoughts, its memories, and able to create a convincing imitation of whoever it is that it is devoured and copied.
How does it copy their clothes, though?
It does not. It tears through their clothes.
Right, but like if you are now Steven, and then 10 minutes later the thing got you and tore through your clothes to get you, and now I'm talking to the thing, but it still looks like it's wearing your clothes.
Yeah, maybe everybody has more than one change of clothes of the same shirts.
What I love the very most about this movie, aside from the score, the cast, the premise, just the setup, the look, the sound, it's infamous because a lot of people were repulsed by the extreme splatter, carnage, gore, monster effects, call it what you will. But I think the magic of this movie is what Carpenter does outside of that gory stuff, the isolation of this location, the setting, the buildings that they're in, the long tracking shots down the empty hallways, the paranoia of looking at three guys and knowing that one of them's an alien and you can't speak up or you can't say anything because it might be two of them, who knows? And just the suspense of it. He knows, Carpenter has not made a lot of gory films. He knows that if you set up like an autopsy scene and it's viscerally unpleasant, now the audience is kind of off balance for the rest of the movie. You've already shown me something that was visually unpleasant. If you do it on a dime real quick and show me something else like that real quick, it's going to leave a mark. And he knows that. And that's why there are so many iconic moments of visual nastiness, beautiful Rob Bottin monster effects, gore, latex, call it what you want. And they are so impactful because he knows how to deliver them and when to deliver them and how to pitch his actors surrounded by this viscera. You know, I love the quieter moments in this movie that set up the, oh God, what am I looking at? Get him, the entire blood test sequence and when they're tied to the couch.
It's good.
It's just so, so cool. It's so intense and so suspenseful.
Which that comes directly from the source material.
Yeah.
That idea of, okay, well, if any part of it is alive as everything else of it, then we can take blood from people, and if we hurt that blood, it will react.
And that's kind of a novel idea, is that, like, any portion of your body pops off, it becomes its own sustainable organism. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there are animals for whom that is true. Famously, you know, there are kinds of earthworms or other worms that if you cut them in half, they will regrow. Each half will regrow the other half. And there are obviously, you know, which maybe that is where the also where they where the 51 version sort of thought of that as the jumping point, because there are a lot of obviously that this is true of plants, right? Like every banana you've ever eaten is literally a clone of every other banana you've ever eaten, because they don't we don't reproduce bananas.
Right. And it's just as simple as if I give you a ficus plant and you cut a clipping and replant that, now you have two plants.
Yep.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And it's extrapolating that into a sentient being, which is really fun and why this premise keeps being brought back over and over and over. Stephen, let me ask you this. Now, what is it that they do at these bases? What do you think? There's the weather station, right? Why does a weather station need like 15 men?
Oh, I doubt it does, especially not in the middle of winter. That's one of the things that like was a little bit unrealistic about this. You know, the population of Antarctica fluctuates wildly during the summer when there's sun and it's, you know, freezing cold. There are, you know, relatively large number of people there. I believe the, you know, at its peak, it's around like 1,000 people or so. I don't know what it would have been in 1982. But then most of those people leave before the harsh winter season where it goes from really cold to unfathomably cold. This definitely did not look like a winter in Antarctica to me. Certainly there was way more daylight than you would expect in the middle of winter in Antarctica, which is to say none, because Antarctica is all contained within the Antarctic Circle for the most part, which means that in the winter you basically don't see the sun at all. Now it could be late fall, early winter, I suppose, but even then in that case you'd have the sun would never go overhead. It would only ever sort of skim the horizon. So it would look like sunset pretty much for all day long, and all day would be a couple hours at most. So that aspect of it certainly didn't ring true, but I don't know very many films, you know, that have actually succeeded in that regard. Certainly Midsommar didn't, and Insomnia.
So, okay, so let me ask you this. You're watching the film, obviously you're giving it a fair shake, and you're feeling a little bit cold on the characters and the setting, the story, blah, blah, blah. When it gets to, like, the set pieces, the key moments that everybody loves and everybody talks about, was your reaction, eh, or, all right, these moments are pretty interesting. Yeah,
mostly, eh. I mean, look, I understand what people like about them. I think they're cool. I think they are cool from an artistic sort of point of view of, like, I think they have a lot of really, really neat ideas, I guess is what I'm saying. I love the idea of him trying to, you know, do the heart paddles and the guy's chest opening up and then ripping his arms off. Like, that's an awesome idea. I just feel like the actual, like, the minute they cut back to that shot and you look down and you realize, oh, that's not the guy laying there anymore. That's a dummy. You know, it just, it's
oh, yeah.
None of it.
You know, by that point, I'm fully into it. I mean, the effects in this movie are so freaking great.
It looks like makeup effects to me. And so you can appreciate it in the same way that, like, I can look at a painting and see brush strokes and be like, that's a really cool painting. I can see the brush strokes. And that doesn't necessarily hurt my enjoyment of the painting because, but if I looked at what was supposed to be a photograph and saw brush strokes, I'd be like, well, that doesn't look like a photograph. That doesn't look like a real thing anymore. That looks like an impression of a thing.
I guess what happens is, like, your brain is watching, like, the alien when it has what's his name on the table, and his head is, like, stretching off, and then the little, like, lanyard thing lassos out of his mouth. And I guess it's easy to look at that moments in those slow moments and go, wow, it's all really impressive effects, but I'm now commenting on the effect,
yeah,
not
exactly.
The story.
Exactly. Like,
but
I,
no, I don't. I honestly don't.
Okay.
I'm so, like, I've seen the film so many times that I'm so connected, or not connected, but familiar with these characters that I you know, they're not deep characters, but, like, I am into that whole sequence, and I don't have that disconnect of, oh, this, now I'm just looking at latex on latex.
Yeah, see, that's, I can't, like, for me, that's all I see. I see effects work. I don't see a head on spider legs. I see, oh, that's kind of a cool, neat effect of that they made a fake head and put it on spider legs.
But is that all movies?
No. I mean, that's not all movies. Absolutely not. Again, that probably comes back to the fact that I have never once felt emotionally engaged in this movie. And so I don't see the characters as people. So all I'm aware that I'm watching a movie the entire time. And I was just never felt emotionally involved in the story enough to suspend my disbelief.
That is a fair point. You could say that had Carpenter spent another 10, 12 minutes setting up, you know, the relationship between Childs and MacReady, then the bit at the end where Childs says, leave him out in the cold, you know, then maybe that would have more of a punch to it, because we didn't really set these characters up that well. So, you know, I could see that's a fair gripe. To me, they're just interesting enough and just human enough to make their plight terrifying.
Yeah, like I said, the only character in this entire thing that felt like that to me was Wilford Brimley's. And again, that was mostly his performance and those few moments where he gets to actually demonstrate his character through action, which I think was sadly lacking for basically every other character except for Kurt Russell, whose establishing action is, I'm going to destroy a computer even though I'm at the South Pole and can't just go get another computer. I'm going to literally destroy this thing.
Yep.
Because it beat me.
I also think Donald Moffat, who plays Gary, I think he's good too. He's the guy who, when the Norwegians start shooting at the dog, he breaks a window out and puts a bullet in the guy's head. And
yes.
Just with one shot.
The old guy.
And that brings an interesting dichotomy there, which is you killed this guy and he feels he looks guilty about it. And it looks like they're setting him up to be the pushy, officious authority figure, but he crumbles really quickly. And it's an interesting, I think that's an interesting character.
But what is it? See, I was also very confused about what all those people were doing there, what each of their roles were in the place. Like, again, I know that what's his name was a helicopter pilot. I don't have any idea what Donald Moffat was. It kind of seems like maybe he was the leader of them, but then I don't know whether, like, he seemed like he might be military, but I don't know if that's true or not. Like, I don't really know what the purpose of the base was.
No, it's a fair question. I think T.K. Carter, who plays Knowles, I think he is like the cook.
I think there's a guy named Windows, but I don't know why he's called Windows.
Windows is the communications guy,
okay,
played by Tom Waits. Richard Mazur is the guy who's in charge of the dogs. He plays Clark. Bennings, the one who has the wire rim glasses. I forget what he does exactly. He's a doctor.
There was a doctor. I remember the doctor.
No, there's many doctors. Richard Dysart plays a doctor, and obviously so does Wilford Brimley.
I got the sense there was only one actual medical doctor. The other guys were all scientific doctors.
Oh, right. Good.
Am I wrong?
And Fuchs is the guy with the glasses. My bad. Childs is Keith David, who is amazing. I love that guy.
I love Keith David, but again, he's not giving anything to do in this that gives him any personality at all.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, that's a fair gripe. I think if you were to say, I like everything about this movie that you do, but less because I don't have characters that I really love or interested in, that's a fair argument.
So let's talk about the science, what little there is, again, even in this movie, in terms of, I mean, we've touched on a little bit of this stuff. I guess the only thing, again, that jumped out at me about this movie in particular, which was egregious, was the flamethrower use indoors. I mean, okay. Unless this building is made out of, like, fireproof, I don't know what.
Asbestos is fireproof, isn't it? That's something I was going to ask you about. All right.
There's so much stuff in there.
Wait. Let's pretend, let's go back, like, 3-6 months. And whoever's in charge of this weather, they're outfitting the entire facility. And they're like, all right, we need a refrigerator. We need a washing machine. We need radar. We need a radio to talk to outside authorities.
Right.
How many flamethrowers do we need? And they sit around a table. And these people who are like, what practical reason would you need? All right, if I was in the Antarctic for 6 months, I would feel good knowing that there was a flamethrower nearby. Yes, I would. But what is the practical reason for that?
Just for entertainment's sake. Because I imagine it's very boring down there, especially after you've destroyed the only computer that'll let you play chess.
I know. Imagine like if there was no alien, there was no monster, and then the whole movie is just like, who the fuck poured their martini in the only computer we have up here? What are you
doing? It's our only source of entertainment. I've read all 8 books already, guys. Come on.
You watched all our game shows and videotapes.
I can't. Maybe you need a flamethrower to melt ice? I don't know. I don't think you need a flamethrower at all. But
like on one hand, I get it. You're surrounded by ice and snow, so you would maybe something would come up where you need to throw flame. But What? Aside from alien invasion, what is it that would require you to have?
You discover a secret Nazi base under the ice?
Multiple flamethrowers at this location. Multiple.
I don't know. Yeah. There. Are.
Okay, so what you're saying is, like, there's that great scene when Windows gets picked up and kind of disemboweled by the head, and then he falls back down, and Russell comes back in and turns the flamethrower on, and he burns it. And so what you're saying is that would literally burn the entire building down within 5 minutes.
Exactly. They would have burned this entire building down 3 times over by the end of this movie.
Right.
They wouldn't need to worry about the thing because they'd all be dead from smoke inhalation and or fire. So no, it's ridiculous the number of times. And then they'll show the little fires kind of burning in the corner or whatever, but somehow they never seem to catch on to anything else.
But twice in this movie, they also show some of the secondary characters coming right in and blowing it out with a fire extinguisher, not even told. It happens early in the dog sequence, which is unreal, and then it happens later in the Windows, when Windows gets burned up. They come pouring right in with the fire extinguisher.
Well, that
to
makes
put it
some
out,
sense, right?
As if to answer your complaint.
Yeah, but then by halfway through the movie, they're just like, ah, screw it. We're just gonna flamethrower everything, and we don't have time to actually put the fires out. But since it would be inconvenient on a story level for the entire place to just burn down, we're going to go ahead and just pretend that the fires put themselves out? I don't know. So
let's talk about the biology of the creature. So how does it work exactly? You're sitting at home on your computer. The thing comes behind you, kills you, absorbs your body, replicates you.
Yeah.
Now there are two things, the original entity and now Stephen B.
Oh, it's never clear.
Yeah.
It's never entirely clear, like, whether this thing... Well, we never see two people, right? We never see two versions of the same person, so it's implied... You know, it devours that one guy at one point, and it's in the process of replicating him after eating him. You know, they flamethrower it, and they autopsy it and find the dead guy inside it.
I also love how they don't need – I could just see Carpenter on the set looking at the script, looking at the pages and going, you know what? Don't need the electric blanket. It just thaws, period. I'm not – cut the electric blanket. We don't need it.
Both of which are preferable to what happens in – the third movie.
Well, okay. Let me ask you this then, because this is a key component of all three films. We have discussed in the past why you couldn't freeze me inside of a glacier and then bring me back 500 years later, and it is because the freezing process would destroy my brain. It's in a nutshell. That's what would happen, right?
Yeah, well, it would destroy your cells, yeah.
And destroy my body brain. Cells, not well, just my brain.
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So explain how that would work relative to our physics.
Well, so that's a biology question as much as it is a physics question. It's the combination of the way physics of water works with the way that our bodies are built, in particular the fact that we're 70% water and the way that our cells are built and the way that they function. So it's those two things sort of in concert. So it's absolutely plausible that this alien with its very different biology from ours – I mean there are animals or there are, you know, living organisms on Earth that can be frozen – literally indefinitely and rethought again years, centuries later and still be alive.
Now we move on to The Thing 2011, which was controversial among horror fans because it's all like, oh my God, how dare you? As if, you know, Shakespeare and Hitchcock have not been remade. So you know right. what? Carpenter can be remade too. I think the guy is amazing and I love his films, but you know what? Films get remade. That's the nature of the art medium. It's the nature of the beast.
If films didn't get remade, the 1982 thing would not exist. That's the weirdest thing about this argument to me.
I did not love this movie when it first came out. I don't believe that I was savage to it. I just was kind of, I think the movie as a whole left kind of a meh in my head.
Yeah.
And I think one of the main problems with this one is that it feels rushed from the start. Steven, you made a fair point that the 82 version could have used a bit more characterization in Act 1. I think this movie could have used a bit more, too, because, man, it feels like the marching orders were get to the alien within 15 minutes.
Oh, no. See, my understanding of it is that Heiserer's script was very much took its time and was about building suspense and dread and whatever else. And in fact, that was how they largely shot the movie, and then they played it for test audiences, and test audiences were like, oh, there's not enough happening. It's not action-packed enough. And they actually went back and reshot a whole bunch of stuff, including a new ending, and changed the pacing of it so that it got to the Alien Fester or whatever else. Like that was a studio note. That was a test audience note that was not part of the intentions of the original filmmakers.
And obviously, Eric Heiser went on to write Arrival and is a fantastic screenwriter. And I think that, you know, this to me feels a lot like an Alien 3 situation, which is where if you had left it to the writer and the director and just left them to their own devices, they probably would have turned out something better than this, which is half good ideas and half obviously studio notes, like you said. My main gripe about this movie, and it's been well documented, is that virtually all of the practical effects were replaced in post-production with digital effects. And of those digital effects, some are pretty damn good, and a few are just downright awful.
Well, the last half hour was really where the digital effects started to just
get... Yeah, I agree.
Like, everything up until that point, you know, there were some things that didn't quite work all the way, but to me, they didn't quite work in the same sort of way that some of the original practical effects didn't quite work all the way. Like, if you're invested in the story, if you're in, you know, if you're invested in the world, then you're just going to buy into the reality of this thing.
Yeah, no, you're right. But there's nothing egregious in the 82 version where you're looking at the shot for a few seconds and there's like a digital face on the monster at the end of this movie.
That's kind of pretty terrible.
And there's nothing like that in 82 version.
I disagree with you vehemently. I think that everybody is looking at the 82 version with these rose-colored glasses of like, oh, well, it's so cool and creative and whatever else. I think that the corpse that opens up and swallows the guy's hands looks cheesy and fake. I think that there's a thing shortly thereafter where he's burning the head, I think, with the flamethrower, and they keep cutting back and forth, and it's in various stages of being melted, and all of that stuff looks laughably bad to me. Like, not just, okay, well, this is, I'm not in the story, so I only see effects. Like, some of that stuff looks genuinely like this is cheesy and dated and looks like a bad B movie. So, I you know, again, I'm probably going to get pilloried for this, but I will agree that bad practical effects oftentimes look better than bad digital effects, or at least, you know, allow you to – they don't take you out of the story quite as much sometimes, but yeah.
Well, I mean, it's exactly like yesterday, this trailer for the Harrison Ford version of Call of the Wild came out, and the dog in the trailer is glaringly fake, glaringly fake. It looks like a cartoon dog in a live-action film. Uh-huh. And I'm not criticizing the use of CG. What I'm criticizing is you just pulled me right out of your movie.
Well, so, but look, like, people, I don't think it's the problem is CG. I think the problem is it not being used properly or not being done artfully. And that's the thing that is very, very difficult, as we both know from having made a movie that has some CG that is less than successful. Sometimes you have a vision in your head of how you think a thing is going to look, and it doesn't look the way you did. I imagine, and I don't want to put words into John Carpenter's mouth, but I certainly imagine that there are aspects of that 1982 version that he looks at and goes, man, that doesn't look nearly as good as the thing that I had in my head when I envisioned how we were going to shoot this thing. And again, I think he did a good job. I think that all of that stuff is really creative and interesting, but not all of it works 100%. And that's the nature of making a movie.
All right, you're fair enough. Let's take that a step further. So let's say a few of the practical effect shots in 1982 don't work perfectly. Okay, that's just part of filmmaking. This is a situation in which entire sequences with practical effects were literally painted over with digital.
Yeah, but have you seen the original sequences? Because
a few of them, but they weren't finished. And they look bad, but that's because they weren't finished.
I feel like, for me, watching this movie this time around, because I remember very little about it from having seen it in the theater. It didn't make a very big impression on me. I don't think it will this time either, although I found it more engaging in the moment than I did the 82 version. Until that last act. And then the last act just kind of turns it into an action movie with CGI effects that are almost entirely unsuccessful.
Yeah, I definitely like this movie more the second time around. Definitely. However, that lot of Act 3, especially the bit where they like go onto the ship and they're falling, and it feels like a sequence that was made literally so they could have something colorful for the trailer.
Yeah.
Like that sequence looks that – it's that unnecessary and that –
yeah.
Well, superfluous means unnecessary. So.
And that final creature, the final, you know, the boss battle is ridiculous looking. Like,
yeah,
it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible because it looks like all CG.
So let's talk. Like, we could break it up into two thirds, like the first hour and then the last third.
Right.
Because I honestly like the first hour of this movie a lot more than I did the first time. I do think that it kind of trades the like quiet, slow dread of the 82 version with just let's have a couple more attack moments.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's fine. You know, it's like it's a different world now. It's a different audience. And, you know, if you want slow dread and quiet paranoia, you can go for the 82 version. But, you know, I could see why our argument here was instead of doing that, let's give the audience, you know, a handful of additional monster attack sequences because
we
get it a couple times in the 82. But
this
with the advent of digital, now they can have the alien do a lot more nasty physical stuff.
Well, so what it did highlight for me is a thing that I think is also a flaw in the 82 version. A flaw is not really the right word, but what I don't understand about either of these movies, if it's egregious in 2011, is why and when the thing decides to reveal itself, right? Because its entire point is that it can inhabit people and those people won't know that it's the thing. And then every once in a while it just decides, you know what, screw it. I'm just going to tear this guy's face open and attack somebody while on a helicopter. Or while, you know, we're just, you know, I'm leading this guy away and suddenly his arm comes off. And again, that's a cool visual. It's a neat sort of idea just from a, you know, as an individual element. But when you stop and try to think about the psychology of this thing that is trying to infiltrate human beings so that it can escape and ultimately reproduce and take over the world is presumably what it's after. Like, why does it sometimes just go, you know what? Screw it. I'm just going to say, I'm the thing. Here. And then turn into a monster.
Why wouldn't you just dig down into the ground and be like, come and get me, motherfuckers? You know, like.
Well, no, I'm just like, why? It has successfully imitated somebody. All it needs to do now is get off the base in the guise of that person. And yet every once in a while, for reasons that are never explained, like it'll just go, you know what? Never mind. I don't have the patience for that. I'm going to have my arm crawl off and try to eat this other person. Like, why? And again, it does it in the 82 version as well, because it's like, okay, well, then why does he suddenly have the corpse open up?
Right. What is the thing's biological endgame?
Yeah.
Like, would it ultimately want to replicate every human in the world so that now there are 6 billion things that look like humans but are actually just the one thing? Is that its end goal? Like, then what?
Well, I mean, even if its end goal is to just, like, you know, reproduce enough so that it can then start murdering people and taking, you know, like, its primary goal, and it's clearly intelligent— Right? Its primary goal, I'm isolated. There's like 12 people here. That's the best I'm going to be able to do. I need to get off of the space somehow. I guess in the 2011 version, its goal is to get back to the ship so that it can take off, which is what that whole last act is about. In the 82 version, it's not. Again, they keep surmising that its goal is to get out of the base so that it can infiltrate the rest of the world. And if that's the case, then it's not doing a particularly great job of that, is all I'm saying.
Well, in the 82, Blair thing is building that little spaceship, which is another aspect of that movie that kind of strains credibility just a little, because I just find it hard to believe that this doesn't matter if it's a person or an alien in a person's body. To build that thing in the course of, like, what, a couple hours?
Yeah.
Seems a little. But does the science in any of these films— Well, not the first one, but does the science in the second and third film get any more complicated than it's replicating cells? That's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you know, that stuff is not super believable. Like when they look through the microscope in the third one or in the second one, they do it with a computer animation.
Model, yeah.
You know, oh, I'm just going to take this thing's cells and then I'm going to replicate the cells and then I'm going to look like the cells. Like, that's all well and good. But if it literally just replicated all of our cells, then it would just be us and it wouldn't be able to do any of these weird things that it's capable of doing, like, you know, forming mouths in strange places or breaking pieces of itself off or whatever else, like if all it was doing was replicating our cells.
Though I do have had a change of heart on the 2011. It really doesn't delve into the 8 people looking at each other across a room and wondering which one is the thing. It really kind of doesn't. It's more of a straightforward monster movie with a little bit of that.
Yeah, the middle third of it does that. I like the idea. You know, I feel like they felt like they couldn't just repeat the whole blood thing because it's so iconic. And
yeah, and they almost do it as a joke. They almost do it as like an in-joke of how why they can't do it. But I will give Heiserer and whoever else worked on this script credit. They clearly wanted to tie this into the 1982 version, but they also did come up with some of their own ideas. And one thing that the original or the 82 version never touches on, and I think is a really cool idea, is that it can't imitate inorganic material.
Right.
Which is why where if the thing attacked you, you might find three or four little pieces of silver. Why? Because they're fillings from your teeth, and the alien can't replicate that.
Right.
And that's kind of interesting, and it does.
Yeah. And that scene, kind of takes the place of the blood scene in terms of, okay, well, there's this tense moment, and we don't know who is. The only problem with that, as I was watching this time especially, I was like, because they end up with like four people have fillings and four of them don't and claim either they have porcelain fillings or whatever else. And I'm just kind of like, almost any adult, especially any adult in 1982, is going to have some sort of dental work. you don't survive to 30, 40 years old without a cavity.
Right. But this interesting thread kind of raises more questions, because here's the thing. If I have six fillings and then the alien kills me and replicates me and you look in my mouth, what do you see instead of the fillings?
Holes.
Do I have, are there holes?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what he's looking for. The holes. Okay.
Yeah.
You would assume that maybe you would just fill in that enamel. If you were in a replicating alien,
but clearly that must be what happens, because otherwise she would see that there were fillings missing as opposed
while I do give them credit for trying to do their own blood tests, gimmick, just sticking a flashlight in someone's mouth is not quite as suspenseful as the blood being burned with the hot wire.
It does turn out to be really, I like it by the end, especially when she asks Edgerton, "Do you know how I knew that you were you and not the thing when you came in before?" And he's like, "How?" And she said, "Because you had an earring." And then we realize he does not have an earring now, and he actually grabs the wrong ear, and she roasts him.
Yep.
And he doesn't ever thing out, even as he's burning up, which I think is the movie's way of kind of like being like, "Well, wait, maybe she was wrong. Maybe that was a mistake. Maybe he actually was a person. And she just killed a person. Maybe she's a thing," because it ends with this long, slow push in on her face as she either thinks about what she's done or imagines.
I love Mary Winstead.
She is the only thing I remembered about this entire movie. Was her.
She is excellent. I often had a problem with that trope of often a young woman, but could just as easily be a young man, like the wunderkind who is like the ultimate expert. And I'm thinking, all right, even if she was a brilliant geologist or biologist, by dint of her age, there are going to be experts much more experienced than her.
Yeah, she was 26 years old when they made this movie.
And so that the youth of that kind of strains credibility, but her performance does not. She's great. She's always great. Another addition that they put into the film, if I chop the thing into six bits and each one is now its own autonomous thing, why couldn't it choose to do that on its own?
Right.
And kind of shrug off, and now it's shrugged off its forearm, which turns into like a little spider?
Wormy spider thing, centipede, kind of.
Yeah, and it's like the alien is clearly using that talent of its own. Before it was kind of involuntary. Right. We chopped it up, now it's in four pieces, and now it's doing it on its own. It's kind of... But so that leads me to the question of why doesn't it just turn itself into 1,000 of those?
You're right. It could just split itself into six pieces or 12 pieces, however many of them there are, and then go take over each of them. Yeah.
It just makes me wonder how much of this was practical at one point, Like the Eric Christian Olsen, like the wise-ass character, he's like the frat bro type. I thought he was actually pretty decent in this movie, and he has a horrible death where the monster kind of absorbs half of his head and kind of congeals the two together. And no offense to the artists who worked on this movie, not a great effect.
It's the moment where they combine their faces was not particularly great.
Yeah.
But it's
a cool idea.
Right. Yeah. Well, so then we see later versions of it that are a mix of the practical and the CGI, and I think those tend to be more successful. That exact moment where their faces are merging doesn't work at all. But once it happens, it cuts to another shot of where their faces are already stuck together. That was either makeup or just an entire puppet, and that looked fine.
Yeah, I will give the movie credit, because whether it was practical or digital or practical and then replaced with digital, the designs of the alien are pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, they're pretty elaborately gruesome and alien and bizarre.
There were places where I honestly couldn't tell, you know, particularly like when they were roasting things with the flamethrower and you'd see something writhing around in the flames. There were a lot of times where I was like, I can't tell whether that was a puppet.
Oh, yeah. No, that's fair. I mean, there are some really impressive designs. And, yeah, I think you're right. Until it kind of gets excessive in Act 3, I think the digital gore and digital monster effects are fairly solid. Well, here's a really interesting angle I want to get into, because you watched 82 and 2011 back-to-back. So this is where we're getting into high spoiler territory here. The very end of the film has a dovetail that kind of – connect some puzzle pieces back to the 82 version. And I'll ask you this, because you kind of, I guess, like the movies at arm's length in a way. Does that connection work for you?
Well, so I did not know going into watching the 2011 version the first time, because of its title probably more than anything, and because it had been described as a remake, I thought it was a remake. And I was not familiar enough with the original to remember the whole Norwegian thing at the beginning of that and any of that stuff. So, like, I thought it was a remake, and it was only in that end credit sequence where, you know, the dog starts running away from the guys in the helicopter that I connected it to, oh, okay, this is the beginning of, like, this was a prequel, which, again, I didn't know that going in. I thought it was a remake. I think I think they made a mistake in just calling it The Thing, to be honest. I think, like, if they had called it, you know, The Thing colon something, it probably would have, I don't know that it would have done better, but it would have been, if people weren't thinking of it as a remake. Because again, we've talked about it as a remake this whole time, but it's not a remake. It is a prequel.
I think you just nailed it. When something has the exact same title, we are kind of conditioned to think that's a remake,
right?
Period. Like, it has the same title. If you had called it The Thing Reborn, The Thing Arrives, The Thing Explored, whatever you want to call it. But you're right, it shouldn't have the same title, except the marketing department said, oh, yes, it should.
Yeah, and so I thought I was watching a remake. I didn't realize I was watching a prequel, but it is absolutely,
I think, that's what they want.
Well, I don't think it is, because if you go back and, you know, so now having researched a little bit after the fact, they were painstaking, apparently, in recreating that set, in recreating, you know, a lot of the situations that Kurt Russell and Wilford Brimley come across over the course of that thing, you know, of like, okay, well, how did this end up in this place? How did this, you know, how did this guy end up here? How did the axe end up in the wall? Like, they were apparently sat there on set with printouts of everything that they could find, of screenshots from the 1982 version, from the Norwegian excursion in the 1982 version, in order to make it a true prequel so that all of those things matched up.
Right. And you get a good taste of that at the end, at very end of the movie. And whether they cut a bunch of that stuff out or just decided to, and then just decided to keep it as like a postscript, I don't remember what I thought of it the first time, but I've come around on it. I like it. Yep. I honestly do. I like the way it's presented as kind of a twist ending.
The problem is it doesn't wrap up her fate in any way. Right? Because then where was she in the original movie? Like, is she still there? Because, you know, at the end, she crawls into this truck and she's presumably going to go, you know, what's his name said they were going to go to the Russian station. They somehow end up at the American one instead.
Yep. No, but it's a fair point. What happens to her? Even though I do kind of like the fan service at the end connecting the two films together. And it was.
Well, so the 82 version takes place over a day or two, right?
Yeah, like I think a full, like at most 48 hours, 36
right.
hours.
So, like I mean, like that's conceivably she's, you know, literally spending that entire time just in the snowmobile trying to get to the Russian station and either get snowed in or she gets there and she tries to warn them and they can't get, I mean, you know, they established in the 82 version that they can't really get in touch with anybody by radio. So, like, conceivably she got out and she's fine.
Living, maybe she moved to the Bahamas.
There, you could very easily make a sequel to both of these.
So what, you think that there was a lot more of that stuff peppered throughout the whole film, or it was mainly done for the end?
No, like I said, I think that, again, you know the movie better than I do, but from what I have read, if you go back and watch the Norwegian part of the 82 version, like the set matches, like all of that stuff matches.
The character who kills himself and then the blood freezing is coming out. I was like, you know, it's one of the most iconic or memorable little moments of the first half of this movie. And kudos to them for like bringing that part, you know, like that's an interesting.
And then they show him at
cue.
The end. Yeah, they show him at the end in the state that they that the Americans find him in a couple days later. So I think it is a true prequel. I don't think it is a remake.
No, it's not. But like, you could still call it a remake, so that way people can enjoy kind of the twist at the end.
All right. Well, so we have not talked about a whole lot of science because there, you know, because it's more fun to talk about the movie in this particular case. The only thing that I have left on my notes, scientific wise, is the ending of The Thing, 2011, where she shoves a grenade in its mouth. And it explodes in a giant fireball.
When they just spent the entire film explaining that each organism is autonomous. So therefore, blowing it up with a grenade is literally, literally the worst thing you could do.
Well, blowing it up with an actual real-world grenade would be the worst thing that you could do, because that would just blow it up into, you know, lots and lots of different pieces. In this case, it is a, thankfully for her, a movie grenade. And a movie grenade apparently explodes in a giant fireball, which is the exact opposite of the way that a grenade is supposed to function, which is a pressure wave that throws shrapnel out. But in this case, again, it blows into a giant fireball, which consumes the entire thing and it burns up.
All right, so let's just do it this way. Entertainment value and scientific intelligence, Stephen, for 1951. Go.
You know, it's hard to judge old movies. It's a C, I guess. It's tempting to try and determine whether you should grade on a curve, you know, in terms of entertainment value. There are plenty of old movies that I find incredibly entertaining and engaging, despite their sort of hokiness or their old-fashionedness.
Datedness.
Right. Whereas this one is not one. This one just kind of just feels dated. It feels like a Twilight Zone episode that's, you know, a not particularly memorable Twilight Zone episode. So, I guess. Scientific intelligence. You know what? I'm gonna punt on all three of these movies as far as scientific intelligence. I don't think any of them have anything particularly egregious, but they're all so just, yeah.
Now, let's just move on because I have to hear it. What is your entertainment value grade for John Carpenter's 1982 classic, The Thing?
I'm just going to go C across the board, all three of them. I think they're all C movies. I don't think any of them are better than any of the other ones. I like aspects of each of them. I dislike aspects of each of them. I don't want to
publish this podcast. I feel like you just came out as a Republican or something. Oh my God. They're all the same.
I'll put it this way. I think that the 82 movie is obviously more influential. I think it is much more memorable than the 2011 version, but less engaging. So
I will give the original Thing out of respect and just for its place in history, I'm going to say a B-. Because, you know, it had some very influential ideas and some good performances. It's not a bad movie. It just dated and dry. The 82 Thing, A+.
Oh, there you go.
I think it's absolutely brilliant. And the 2011, if you had asked me a few months ago, I would have said like C-. But now I'm going to go B- on the prequel remake. I do have nitpicks with it. I think that a lot of the stuff in Act 3 is just drum kit down the stairs, loud and weird and unnecessary.
Yeah.
But when it's just dealing with horror and them running from a monster, it's pretty entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, I can't fault you for any of those ratings.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us for some things. 1951, 1982, 2011. It's an interesting franchise and one that I was glad to revisit for Science versus Fiction. I will let Steven sign us out. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, please direct all hate mail to @ScottEWeinberg on Twitter. He would love to hear from you about how much of an idiot I am. And I hope that I have not turned you off from this podcast entirely by puncturing a balloon.
You killed
of a beloved. Yeah, I know. I've probably destroyed
our chances of succeeding. You destroyed the entire show. Damn you, Steve.
Thanks for listening. Bye.